It's great to be here. I hope you all are feeling the same way I am. God has truly blessed us. He's given us a nice facility. We've got a nice start last night. Music was great so far today. It's great seeing Norm and Marlene back with us and sharing the feast with us. It's pretty cool stuff. God is good. God blesses us greatly. Now today, I get to open and start talking about things, and my main topic is tabernacling with God in Babylon. And we'll get to there, but first we're going to just do some little background things, because it is the first day of the feast, and we'd be a little amiss if we didn't go through some basics. So we're going to start with some basics, and then we're going to just put our thinking caps on and start imagining some things and putting things together and meditating on some of the things that God has in His Word that remind me of tabernacling with God, but while we're in Babylon. So let's just start. Let's see. It's not working. Of course. Let's see. There we go. I'm going to start with a very simple way of looking at what is actually tabernacle. Tabernacle, and I'm going to use Merriam-Webster's because it's a modern dictionary. And it's tabernacle really hasn't changed a lot in its definitions, but Merriam-Webster says it is the house of worship, specifically a large building or tent used for evangelistic services. That sounds like a very modern definition. And number two is receptacle for the consecrated elements of the Eucharist. That's again going into the Catholic Church and its background. And then number three, often capitalized, a tent sanctuary used by the Israelites during the Exodus. I think we all know that tabernacle. And then gives a couple of archaic definitions as dwelling place, temporary shelter, tent. And then when it's used in the verb form, tabernacle, tabernacling, it's to take up a temporary residence, especially to inhabit a physical body. And it's really interesting because, again, there's a spiritual context to tabernacle and tabernacle. And even our Merriam-Webster's modern dictionary can actually recognize that there's two aspects. There's a physical of we're temporarily dwelling somewhere. And that's what we're all doing here, whether we're in a tent or whether we're in a camper or whether we're in a hotel room or whether we've got a VRBO. It's not our dwelling. It's a temporary device. So it's a physical thing. But how about the other, you know, to inhabit a physical body? We are inhabiting a physical body here. And if we're tabernacling with God, is He tabernacling in our physical bodies? Or if our physical bodies, the things that we do, does it represent what God has in mind for us? Let's see if this will work. Nope. Of course not. All right. One of the things I always like to do is I look at modern translation or dictionary. I always like to go back. I have a 1828. It's almost 200 years old now. It blows my mind. But that dictionary actually gives, and I really like it because it actually defines things and it uses the Bible wherever it can. And that's where we've come in the last 200 years. There's a little contrast of differences between our mindsets today as a nation and our mindsets years ago, 200 years ago. We tried to base things on God, and how far we've come, there wasn't a single mention, really, of this is where we get this definition from. And yet we can look up here in the New Webster's almost 200 years ago. It gives its scriptural references of where it gets its definitions from. And I love it, because it puts it back to God. So again, we see some of the same things, you know, a tent, but it gives Numbers 24. Go look at that if you really want to know what a tent is. Matthew 17, go look at that. Temporary habitation among the Jews, the movable building, a place of worship, a sacred place, our natural bodies. And again, 2 Corinthians, 2 Peter, go look at those and you'll see about our natural bodies. And then God's gracious presence, or tokens of it. Again, go look at Revelation. But think about that definition coming out of the American dictionary. God's gracious presence. And then He tells us to come here and tabernacle with His presence. How much do we contemplate and meditate on that? And it's also that thing that the Catholics have up in the front of their church. But then as a verb, again, to dwell, to reside for a time, to be housed, and then as we say, Christ tabernacled in the flesh. We think about Christ tabernacling in the flesh, and we think about all the scriptures that we have, and we're here to tabernacle with God. Is he tabernacling in our flesh while we're here? Is he tabernacling with us while we're here? Do we get up every day and realize that God has called us here to an appointed time with him so that we can tabernacle every day that we're here with Christ in us? We have that attitude as we're going to go through the feast. So let's look at a couple of basic scriptures to start with. Then we'll go to Leviticus 23. It's almost a given that we have to at least go there once during the feast. So we'll do it on the first day here. And again, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the sons of Israel saying, on the 15th of the seventh month is the Feast of Booths for 7 days to the Lord. On the first day is a holy convocation, you shall do no laborious work of any kind. For 7 days you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the eighth day you shall have a holy convocation and present an offering by fire to the Lord. It is an assembly. You shall do no laborious work. There are appointed, these are the appointed times of the Lord, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, to present offerings by fire to the Lord, burnt offerings and grain offerings, sacrifices and drink offerings. Each day matters on its own day. Besides those of the Sabbaths of the Lord, and besides your gifts, and besides all your votive and free will offerings which you give to the Lord. Now we break this down. Again, we have on the 15th day of the seventh month is the Feast of Booths for 7 days. We're here. This is day one. It's great that we can look out and say there's 6 more days coming after this, and we'll be here for that. And this is part of what he's saying the Feast of Tabernacles is about. And then there's that eighth day that comes in after that. And then we are to have holy convocations on the first and the eighth. Holy convocations, getting together, all together with his people. And it's so wonderful to see so many of his children here. Because if God placed you here, he has a reason for you to be here. God has an appointment. These were his appointments that he wanted us to come to. We are to do no laborious work on the first and the eighth. We're to come before him so that we can worship him. He's freed us from the bondage of this world. Everyone else out in the world today on a Thursday is probably working. Their mindset isn't even here. It isn't about what God has for them. They're involved in something else. But God says, no, 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 take the day off. Come here. Have a holy convocation. Have a sacred assembly. Meet with people of like mind, more of my children, from all sorts of different places. And we get to come together, and we get to be here. And we have a purpose that he gives us for being here. We're to present offering by fire. You know, each day's matter on each day. Do we get up every day during the next seven and say, what is my offering that I have today? What am I giving back to my Lord and my Savior? Because if he's dwelling with me and in me, I should be getting up in the morning and saying, what offering am I giving this day? What does he have for me to give this day? And it may be something different than the day before. Maybe we had the special music like by Norm and Marlene today. That was their offering today. What a beautiful blessing it is to have it. Maybe it is somebody that's going to clean up a coffee spill that somebody else made. But what is that offering that I am giving to God and his children day by day? And each day has a different matter. And it's kind of interesting when you actually meditate on some of these words. Am I even thinking about what he's saying? All the little details, each day its own thing. And then this one I really like because it falls in there. There's this proclaim the appointed times of the Lord. Do we take that personally? That we are to proclaim these appointed times? He's assigned that to each and every one of us in here. that we are to proclaim his appointed times. I think we're going to hear some more about this proclaim later on in the feast. But that's a command that God has for these times. His appointments with us. Are we letting it be known that we are here because of the blessings that he's given to us? Because he's commanded us to come and rejoice for 7 days? Do we look at it very negatively? Or do we look, my God so wants to meet with me and be with me that he has set these signs, times aside, and I proclaim it to whoever I come across? It's a matter that each of us has been assigned. How do we do it? Let's continue on in Leviticus. It says, on exactly the 15th day of the 7th month, when you have gathered in the crops of the land, you shall celebrate the feasts of the Lord for 7 days, and the rest on the first day, and a rest on the 8th day. Now on the first day you shall take for yourselves the foliage of the beautiful trees, the palm branches, the boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. You shall thus celebrate it as a feast of the Lord for 7 days in the year, and a perpetual statute throughout your generations. You shall celebrate it in the 7th month. You shall live in booths for 7 days. All native-born in Israel shall live in booths, so that your generations may know that I had the sons of Israel live in booths, and when I brought them out from the land of Egypt, I am the Lord your God. So Moses declared to the sons of Israel the appointed times of the Lord. How often do we actually go and meditate a little bit that when we come to these things, that it's an appointment with the Lord? That he wanted to meet with us. He called you out to be special, to meet with him. Wow. He cares about each and every one of us, from the small little one here to the oldest here. He cares about each of us, and he said, I want these appointments with you. And we can look, and the appointments were made long before he made man. He had it in his mind, and he wanted to meet. We'll talk a little bit more about this living in booths later, but he tells us to come out because he has a job for us to do, is to think and remember who he is and the things that he's done. We are to gather together. In Deuteronomy 16, starting in verse 13, you shall celebrate. How often does he tell us? You shall celebrate. That mean God of the Old Testament comes out and says, I want an appointment with you, and you shall celebrate. You shall celebrate the Feast of Booths 7 days after you've gathered in from your threshing floor and your wine vat. And you shall rejoice in your feast, and you and your son and your daughter and your male and female servants and the Levite and the stranger and the orphan and the widow who are in your towns. 7 days you shall celebrate the feast of the Lord your God in the place the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce, in all your work of your hands, so that you will be altogether joyful. What a mean God. He's first going to bless us in our work before we come here. And I was talking with Blaine a little bit before services today, and he was telling me about some of the surprise bounty they got and they harvested this year. And it's a blessing from God. And the world around him is looking at him as the fool because he's doing stuff that doesn't make sense to them. But he's preparing so that he can come. And he's blessed in the harvest. How have we been blessed so that we can be here? We have people from Canada here. We have people from Texas here, from Tennessee here. We have people from Oregon here. All over the place, Michigan. We've been blessed so we can be here. Are we thankful for what he's given us? Because he says if you come and notice this list here, you know, you, your son, your daughter, your male and female servants, Levite, stranger, orphan, and widows who are in your towns. That's a big job to make sure that they are all rejoicing in the feast, right? But again, that command is if we do these things, he will make sure our produce is good and he blesses it. And if we do these things, the work of our hands will be blessed. And then we can be even all more together, everyone together, joyful in what he has given. These are the things that that mean God of that Old Testament is commanding us to do. So let's look in Deuteronomy 16:16. He does give us some things. He gives us responsibilities because he says, as I bless you,
Now I want you to go and take care of all these people. I want you to go and bless others. I give you the job of, you know, offering yourself or offering different things up every day. But here in 16, he says three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, at the Feast of Weeks, at the Feast of Booths, and you shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. Every man is to give as he is able according to the blessings of the Lord your God, which he has given you. And you shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you according to your tribes. And you shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice. You shall not be partial. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice and only justice you shall pursue, and you shall live and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not plant for yourself an Asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make for yourselves. You shall not set up for yourself a sacred pillar in which God, your Lord your God, hates. It's kind of interesting when you look at this set of scriptures, because, you know, it talks about feast days, then it talks about justice and mercy, it talks about blessings, and then it talks about coming before God and the manner in which we come before God. All in a few short verses. And they're powerful when you take them together. When you take them individually, he says, okay, come before me. Don't appear empty. You know, you have something to give. You have some way of helping. You have some way of reaching out to somebody. And actually, one of the smallest ones here, now I realize he's one of my grandsons, but he came up this morning, Aaron, and he's showing me, I can share this elephant I have with you. I have this horse. I want to share it with you. And it did bring joy to my heart. And yes, he was my grandkid. But that shows that everyone here has something to offer. If an 18-month-old kid can lift me up a little bit today, what can you do to somebody else? Don't come. You're not coming here empty-handed, especially if you're thinking every day of what you can be an offering to somebody. Somebody, somehow. And then he talks us to, you know, goes right from there and says, okay, I want you to appoint judges. And they got to be just. And they got to be, you got to think about not distorting, not taking bribes. Treat everybody equally. It's part of what he wants out of us. Do we treat everybody equally? Not only those that are in this room, but those that we find outside coming in. When we come in, when we leave this place, how do we treat those others? You know, and how we even just leave this facility here, that shows how we respect or don't respect the people that work here, the rules that they've set in place. How do we do that? And God ties that right in with his feast days and says, hey, don't distort justice. Don't be partial. Don't take bribes. Justice and only justice. And if you do that, he says, I'll allow you to possess the land. I will give you blessings. And then he says, you know, goes from right there, and then how do I treat God? How do I treat him? He goes from justice and treating a man to man to how do I treat God? You know, you shall not plant for yourself an Asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord your God. When I come here, am I bringing the world's customs with me? This is an appointment with God. What baggage am I bringing along? And maybe it's not even the customs of the Lord our God. Is my mind on a business deal I have back home? Is my mind on, you know, we've had well problems in this past year just before the feast. My son's got, the son's got well problems. Is my mind on those well problems? Or is the power turned off and I don't worry about it and God will take care of it when I get back? You know, what are the deals that are going on in our minds? Are we bringing that baggage, those asterisks of any kind, and planting them before the Lord here? God says he wants us to treat him with that respect. He's asked us to come with the appointment. He's asked us to come before him. Let's not set up anything that he does not like, that he hates, as he says. The Feast of Tabernacles is a very interesting thing, because God also points that it's not for today. It's for the future. and a time that we're supposed to look forward to. And we spend a lot of time at the feast looking forward to that time. In Zechariah 14, verse 8, it says, "And in that day, living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea and half towards the western sea. It will be summer as well as in the winter. And the Lord will be king over all the earth. And in that day, the Lord will be only one, and his name the only one. And all the land will be changed into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem will rise and remain on its site from Benjamin's gate as far as the place of the first gate to the corner gate. And from the Tower of Hanel and to the king's wine presses, people will live in it, and there will no longer be a curse, for Jerusalem will dwell in security." That ain't today. That's one of the things we know. That area is not in peace at all today. But do we have the faith in his promises? And I know we'll be thinking about that, and this is one of the things we think about during the feast. Won't it be wonderful when that area will dwell? When that area will be there. And then in verse 16 it says, "And then it'll come about that any of those who are left of the nations that went into against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths." With all that we see going on in Jerusalem, in Israel, have we thought about what it's going to be like when Hamas goes up to keep the feast? Or they'll be dead. You know, they're going to have a choice. God always gives a choice. What about Hezbollah? You know, they'll have that same choice. Will they go up or will they be destroyed? But it's something to meditate about, because God says they're going to have that choice, and there will be some that choose the choice of going up and worshiping the true king. I can't even imagine that with them today, with the evil that's there. But at the same time, I've read stories from Hamas children that have seen the light. And that's a little seed that says, you know, what God says is true. We got to remember that God said, wipe out the Moabites. And yet at the same time, Ruth was in the lineage of Christ. He gives everybody a choice. Do you hang on to what you've been raised with, or do you change and follow him? So that brings us to the, you know, real question in the transition here. What about now in this place and time? Because that's always a key, right? I read all these stories. I can meditate on those. But what about me here now? How does all these things come in this place and time? You know, how do we tabernacle with God? And the real question should be not only during this festival observance, but every day while we are sojourning in this world. And we'll go through some scriptures that show we are sojourning. We are aliens, and we are in this world. But God has a plan, and he wants us to be that part of that plan, part of that example. And so how do we tabernacle? Which brings us back to, again, we shall live in booths for 7 days. All the native born in Israel shall live in booths, so that your generations may know that I had the sons of Israel live in booths when I brought them out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Now, how many times does he say that throughout Scripture, really? You think about and meditate on the number of times he says, I tell you to do this, and so people will know that I am the Lord your God. Because I want you to be my example. I want you to be out here in this world, and people will look and say, there's something different. You know, just the people that, you know, we were working with to get this facility. 8 days, kids too. They're going to come out before God in October. School's going on. It's a busy time of year. The start of the last quarter of the year, so you know all the counting things they got. You're going to bring how many people to hear, to come before God? It stands out. when we left our homes, did we, you know, our bosses, our school, our teachers, you know, we say, oh, I'm going to some conference. Or, hey, I'm going to God's Feast of Tabernacles because he commanded it as he wanted an appointment with me. It's a very different context, but that's an assignment each of us had, proclaim. And then I'm going to go and live in a temporary dwelling for 7 days during probably a high season. And I'm taking that time. I still have some crops left in the field that I haven't harvested. I still have this to take care of. I still have that. It's an example. What about me here today? That's a question we should all be asking. How am I proclaiming by coming here? Where did I hide what I was really coming here for? Because God called me to be here. God says one of the things that he gives to Israel and by default therefore to us is you shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which you dwell. For I am the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. How many times does he say that in the Bible as well? Do we think about that? Where I am, where I am dwelling, God's concerned about the example I am leaving so that I don't defile the land, the area around me. Because he should be dwelling with us. He should be dwelling with us, in us, through us, tabernacling. Remember that dwelling with, tabernacling with us, not only here, but when we leave here as well. We have a concentration here because now the eye is on us. I mean, even one of the grocery store in town, talking to the guy yesterday, he says, I was stalking you on the web because I wanted to find out more of what this group was and doing and what you were doing, and I have this thing that knows that you're here, and I know that some of the things you're going to be eating this week, but I wanted to know more. Where we dwell, where we're living, how we're living before the feast, after the feast, but here it's concentrated, it's magnified. And isn't it, you know, you think about it, it's magnified because we're all in one place. God's Spirit magnified. Because it's in each and every one of us here. God's Spirit magnified. And God says this is so that you know that I'm dwelling and walking in your midst. Now there's a diagram of the camp of the ancient Israelites with the tabernacle in the center. But God was walking among them and in them. How often do we think that if God is walking among us and in us, do we think about, are we actually doing something to pollute that commonality that we have? Or are we going to glorify God in what we're doing? So in this place and time, there's so many scriptures we could look at. Numbers 5:1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp every leper, everyone that's walking with a discharge, everyone that is unclean because of a dead person. You shall send away both male and female. You shall send them outside the camp so they will not defile the camp where I dwell in their midst. God dwells here. Now we have a lot of different sanitary laws and a lot of things that we do today. But this is how important it is to God that we reflect him and his Spirit. He says, do you think about, am I clean? If not, shouldn't I become clean? Shouldn't I be? Because he dwells in me. I should be holy. I should be thinking, I want to be holy. I want him dwelling in me. I want him in me, and I want him to reflect him. Leviticus 26:11, moreover, I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul will not reject you. I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt so that you would not be their slaves. And I broke the bars of the yoke and made you walk erect. See, again, he wants to dwell with us, not just here, but in our lives. He wants to tabernacle with us. He wants to give us his Spirit. He wants us to be with him. He doesn't want to reject us. That's not his goal. And that's why he gave us appointments, so we can have this spiritual uplifting, so we can be here among him He wants that to be with us. He wants to walk with us. He wants to be our Lord, our God, and he wants others to see that in our lives and see that it reflects it in our lives. Leviticus 25:23, the land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, but you are aliens and sojourners with me. Do we actually take this to heart? The land that we actually have, our houses that we actually have, they're God's, they're not ours. He's allowing us to use it for a while because it's more important that we are a sojourner with him than what we own, because we really don't own it anyway. And in this day and age, you know, we really don't own it even less because the government's going to step in and take it if they want it because we don't pay our taxes or we don't do this or we don't do that. We don't own it. But you know what? We don't own it. God does. And he allows us to use it. But he wants us to get that message that we're aliens and sojourners with him. That means he's with us when we go. That means he's dwelling with us. Those are the things he wants us to do. Ephesians 2:19. So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints. See, the world may look at us as an alien. The world may look at us as a sojourner. But God is telling us that, yeah, that's how he looks at it. But they look at God the same way because he's walking with us. And that's not the way of the world. It says, you are fellow citizens with the saints. You are of God's household. You have been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Christ Jesus being the cornerstone, in whom the whole building will be fitting together is growing into a holy temple of the Lord. Remember, a dwelling place of the Lord. That's what tabernacles is about, a dwelling place of the Lord. So he's fitting it together, each individual piece coming together. Aliens to the world, sojourners to the world, but we're fellow citizens and fellow bricks. And we're built on a foundation of the apostles and the prophets. The prophets are all those Old Testament books. It all comes together. And here's a New Testament scripture that confirms that we should be looking at the Old Testament as our foundation. And we should be building upon that. Building upon it. Not rejecting it, building upon it. All being fitted together into a holy temple of the Lord, a dwelling place, dwelling with God in spirit. Powerful stuff that comes out because it supports exactly all the things we're doing here. 1 Peter 1 says, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who are chosen. So the aliens are chosen. Are you an alien? Are you a sojourner? God says he's chosen. He chose you. You are here doing these things. He chose you according to the foreknowledge of God the Father by sanctifying work of the Spirit to obey Jesus Christ and be sprinkled with his blood. May grace and peace be yours in the fullest measure. Can we put all that together? It's mind-boggling. He has called us throughout the world, all these strange places in the world. You know, they didn't even think of the places we're coming from at this point in time. They weren't on the map. But they're all the strange places. And we're to be gathered together, chosen with his foreknowledge. Famous scripture in 1 Peter chapter 2. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. You were once not a people, but now you are the people of God. You are not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Again, he ties things together. You know, remember he was telling us to come to the feast and then practice justice, mercy, those kinds of things. And he says, we're a people now. We weren't a people. We've brought us together. We are a people. And we received mercy. Mercy from God to receive that calling. Mercy. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers. I can't even bring that in. Because why? We're not of this world. To abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles so that in this thing in which they slander you as evildoers because that they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. You know, sometimes we forget that we're dropping seeds. We are those seeds. People may not even recognize it until some future time. Sometimes we get frustrated. I get frustrated because I don't see results. You get tired. You get weary because it's not sprouting the results. People aren't responding. People aren't seeing things. People are, you know, too busy. God says it'll be an example for later. It's a seed that's planted for later. Perhaps you are planting a seed for later, and it's received with anger now, but it'll be an example because they observe them, and they will glorify God in the future because they will know the source of where we come from because we dwell with God. He is our God. He is the Lord our God. And they know that, and they can see that, and they'll put it back together so that they'll glorify God in the day of visitation. That's yet to happen, but it's in the future. Deuteronomy 10, verse 17, for the Lord your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God who does not show partiality or take a bribe. Again, this is what he asked us to do. But you know, he's the God of gods, the Lord of lords, the great and the mighty and the awesome. He's the only one that can actually do this perfectly. And he's asking us to dwell and walk with him so that we can reflect that. And so it says, for he executes justice for the orphan, for the widows, and he shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. So show your love for the alien, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. And you shall fear the Lord your God, and you shall serve him and cling to him. And you shall swear by his name. He is your praise, he is your God, who has done these great and awesome things for you, which your eyes have seen. Your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 persons in all. And now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven. Now he's talking to Israel here, but by reference he's talking to us. And one of the things that I've noticed in the last few years, especially, is people are waking up all over the place. There are people that just surprise me continually that are starting, not ready to jump in the water, not ready to go attend the Feast of Tabernacles, not ready, but they're waking up and they're asking. And from surprising places, places you wouldn't think, places that you would last and least expect, they're coming out and saying, there's something that God has, something that I want to be part of, but I'm not sure yet. But I'm seeing it. I'm seeing a hope, a vision that certain people have, and they exhibit it as they go down the street. They exhibit it as they're shopping. They exhibit it at work. They exhibit it at school. Is that the reflection of the Lord our God, the God of gods, mighty and mighty? So they see it. And we're to walk with the attitude of, wow, thankfully God's with me because he's pulled me out of Egypt, this world. Egypt is one of those symbols and nations that are in the Bible that tells us the things that are very worldly. The other, one of the other big ones is Babylon. Because Babylon is, again, just like Egypt, a true place. And there's a lot of attitudes that come in that. Now, Babylon is an interesting one because it has existed. It will exist. There's prophecies about where it started and where it's going. And we have the prophecies in Revelation, and Revelation is going to end with Babylon. So that's something that we actually all have to look forward to. Now, here I've got Babylon's Fawcett Bible Dictionary definition for it. It said Babel means Babylon, and in Hebrew that's true. Babel, Babylon, that's there. So all the stories, and we're probably all familiar with these stories, you know, so that the tower, which should be designated the Tower of Babel, Tower of Babylon, the capital of the country, Shinar, which Genesis refers to it, Chaldea later in scriptures. The name is given by Nimrod in Genesis 10:10, the founder, which means Babel, the gate of the god Ill. So that Babel. Now, a lot of scholars have taken, and I'm glad they put it here, are simply of God. with a capital G. And that's an example of what God said. Don't take the Asherah trees of the world and switch it and give it to me and honor me with. And that's what we've tried to do with this, whoever's wrote the Fawcett's Dictionary here, is tried to do is, of God. And that's a very common thing among the Christians today, is to take it, and we got Babel, of the God ill, and we'll just simply make it of God, change the name, and then it'll be something good. And afterwards, the name was attached to another sense, providence of having order so that it by name should be given originally susceptible to another sense, signifying subsequent divine judgment. So Babel, Genesis 11, 9, from Babel to confound. Again, confounding of the languages. Chaos, actually, which we know, things that are chaos are not necessarily the good things. And because the Lord there did confound the languages of all the earth in order to counteract their attempt by a central city and tower to defeat God's purpose of several tribes of mankind being scattered abroad on the face of the earth and to constrain them as no longer understanding one another's speech to disperse. Now, when we look at the Tower of Babel in our minds, I know that we got a lot of different ideas out there. But, they were building this tower up to the heavens. And some people say it's so they could puncture the heavens. Other people say so that the gods could come down from the heavens. It doesn't really matter. It wasn't of God. Because really the thing with the Tower of Babel, the people were refusing to follow God's command to go and multiply and spread across the earth. They said, no, let's gather together and we'll make a name for ourselves. Not a name for God. And what about all the scriptures that we've just read and gone through? Is that our actions should give glory to God, not to ourselves. That was, again, the revolt. Just like Adam and Eve in the garden, what did they do? They took of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil so that they could themselves decide and not listen to God. Mankind doesn't really change. The New Unger's Bible Dictionary, when talking about Babylon, gives some more of the figurative meaning and things that we should be concentrating and thinking about, too, because, it was a physical place, and we'll read some of those scriptures about the physical place. There's something coming in prophecy. And how does it relate? And how does it relate to me? How does it relate to you in our lives? So the figurative meaning in the prophetical writings, when the actual city is not met, the illustration is to the confusion into which the whole social order of the world has fallen under Gentile world domination. Yes, this world is not dominated by godly people. How often do we think about that? The divine order is given in Isaiah 11. Israel is on her own land in the center of divine government of the world in the medium of the divine blessing with Gentile nations blessed when associated with Israel. Anything else is merely political babble. In the New Testament, Babel prefigures apostate Christendom. That is ecclesiastical Babylon, the great harlot in Revelation. It also prefigures the political Babylon in Revelation, which destroys the ecclesiastical Babylon, and the power of the political Babylon is destroyed by the glorious second advent of Christ. Babylon eats itself in the end. But that's the stuff that's coming, the great harlot. We focus, we think about, what will I do when I have to be subject to Babylon? Or maybe, maybe Babylon's here now. Well, I want to go back now and start looking at some scriptures about Babylon, its creation, people that lived in Babylon. How did they have to act? How did they have to tabernacle and live and dwell and walk with God in Babylon? Now, here's a chart of the kings of Israel. And as one of my grandsons will always tell me, they're not all kings up there. And it's like, no, it's just the major ones. We didn't list them all. But we have the United Kingdom that starts in somewhere, 1010, 1050 in there. We actually have the Kingdom of Israel starting. And what's interesting is to note is that we think, here's God's kingdom. We got Saul that unites them under. Saul had whatever, and then we have David and Solomon. And we go on down, and it's really not all that long till we get to really Jehoiakim, when actually Babylon starts taking captives. And then they actually appoint Zedekiah as king. And it's not too long after that that they actually take all of Israel and put them in captivity. And that happened somewhere around 586 BC. So when we look at this, it's really only 464 years. They go from being a united kingdom to being a people in captivity again. And remember, when they were back in Egypt, Egypt was a lot like Babylon, but they were in Egypt for 430 years. So 400 some years seems to be a time frame that God kind of gives us to wake up, gives us to, maybe we ought to think about, maybe we ought to do something. So let's look at some scriptures in Babylon, the beginnings of Babylon, and here's some, you know, people's names and things. And there should be a couple that will really jump out at you, because, you know, we recognize some of the names and some of the names we just go over. But there are people associated with each of these names. So the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, and Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush were Seba, and Havilah, and Sabta, and Rama, and Septica. And the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. Now Cush became the father of Nimrod. Again, Cush, we think of, how often is Cush mentioned in the Bible? Not in many good ways. Nimrod, we've already mentioned Nimrod once. The land of Canaan and stuff. These lands that God has talked about in negative ways. Do we want to be like them, or do we want to be different? There's some things to ponder. So now Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, or Babylon, and Erech, and Akkad, and Kelna, and the land of Shinar. Now again, Babylon was the capital of Shinar. So he kind of says, oh, the city, but also the whole land. And sometimes we don't put those things together. And from that land, he went forth into Assyria. We know how often God talks about Assyria, and built Nineveh. We know all the stories of Nineveh and what a corrupt place that ended up becoming. And Rehoboth and Calah and Rezin. And between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city. Mizraim became the father of Ludim and Anamon and Leheben and Naphtuhim and Pershurim and Keshulim, from which came the Philistines and Kephathorim. And now the Philistines is an interesting one, because the Philistines, we know how they conflicted with Israel all the time. Well, we have a conflict going on today between what? The Palestinians and Israel still. Palestinians are actually Philistines, and that's where the name comes from. So here, way back in Genesis, we have a conflict that's going on today that is in our news, that we can turn on the news every single day and find something about that conflict that's going on. So when we're talking about Babylon, Babylon is still existing. Babylon's legacy is still fighting in our world today. And just a little map here so that we can kind of know where some of the things are. So we got Israel over here, and on the map we got Gaza, and this is Babylon. The land of Shinar is over here, and here it's called Babylonia. And if we look here, this is where these modern nations do exist. Iraq in Babylonia, Syria, Jordan, Israel, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank. And so again, this same land, the same regions, same names, actually amazingly how close those same names are still there. And if we read the end of the book, we find this thing we look forward to as well. It says that one of the seven angels, in Revelation 17, and one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality, and carried away in the spirit and came to the wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on the scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, and having her hand a gold cup full of abominations and unclean things of her immorality. And on her forehead was the name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly. This is coming. Babylon is coming. Do we think about it? Because God says here in Revelation, that is a major thing, event. And as we see, it started back there in Genesis, and the battle is still going on. How much time? There's a lot of theories that are out there. I don't want to get into all those theories today of who is this Babylon? Who is the ecclesiastical Babylon? Who is the political Babylon? It's there. How much time do we think about it? Because it is part of our lives. The Palestinians, the Philistines are attacking Israel. What do we think about that? How do we reflect that? Are we with God or not with God? Do we believe God? That's a really good question because, there's all this argument in this country, do we support the Palestinians? Do we support Israel? What does God tell us to do? If you haven't thought about that, you should. Because God says that His Spirit is with us. He wants to walk with us. He wants us to reflect Him. How do we reflect Him if we haven't even thought about where we are with Babylon? Jeremiah had a message for Zedekiah. Remember, Zedekiah was put in place by Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar put him in place when he took out Jehoiakim. So the word came to Jeremiah from the Lord, and when King Zedekiah sent him from Pashur, the son of Malchim, Zephaniah the priest, and the son of Messiah, saying, please inquire of the Lord on our behalf, for Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, is warring against us. Perhaps the Lord will deal with us according to all his wonderful acts, so that the enemy will withdraw from us. So he wants Jeremiah to go and beseech God on their behalf. But Jeremiah comes back because Zedekiah wasn't really into that. He said, then say to them, you should say to Zedekiah as follows, thus says the Lord your God of Israel, behold, I am about to turn back the weapons of war which are in your hands, in which you are warring against the king of Babylon and the Chaldeans who are beseeching you outside the wall, and I will gather them in the center of the city, and I myself will war against you with outstretched hand, with mighty arms, even the anger and wrath of the great indignation, and I will strike you down, the inhabitants of the city, both man and beast, and they will die with great pestilence. Then afterwards, declares the Lord, I will give over Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and his servants, and the people, even those who survive in the city from the pestilence, the sword, the famine, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and into the hand of their foes, and into the hand of those who seek their lives, and he will strike them down with the edge of the sword, and he will not spare them nor have pity or compassion. Now we think about that, and we think about what we read about Babylon the Great in Revelation 17, the thing to come. He persecutes and kills the saints, the people of God. And here, King Zedekiah is going down, but so is the rest of the people. Zedekiah was not one that actually followed God. But were the people in the city, they had that option to follow God or not follow God. What were they going to do? But they lost their lives anyway. And Revelation tells us that will happen again. And as we've already said and shown, Babylon is alive today. Continues on and says, and you shall also say to the people, thus says the Lord, behold, I set before you the way of life and death. God's way hasn't changed. So it's before us, each and every one of us, choose life and death. Do I walk with God and receive life? Or do I go the easy way out, follow the people of this world, follow the Babylon of the world, follow the kings of this world, which is a way that leads to death? He who dwells in the city, see, he who dwells in the city, this is being said to, you've got that choice. Will you die by the sword and famine and by pestilence? But he who goes out and falls away to the Chaldeans who are besieging you will live. And he will have his life as his own booty. For I have set my face against the city for harm and not for good, declares the Lord. And it will be given into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he will burn it with fire. It's kind of an interesting thing here because, we think, okay, Babylon, God uses his punishment, right? Babylon is coming. God uses it as punishment. He gives the people in the city, you got a choice. Follow me and live, or don't follow me and die. And here the choice he tells them is, go turn yourself over to the punishment that I put on you. You want to live, go and beseech the Chaldeans that are beseeching the city. It's not a choice that I would have thought, you know, that God, and that's not the choice that Zedekiah was saying, go and tell them to, you know, fight the battle for me. And God said, no, it's punishment against you. And how often do we ponder that? That sometimes God gives us the punishment, and it's the punishment for the nation, but we have to undergo it. And he says, undergo it and walk my way. Do it my way. So as we, you know, tabernacling with God, if we're walking with God, and he tells us, you know, this is the way of life, do we believe him? Even though it doesn't seem right? Do I trust in my defenses, or do I trust and turn myself over to the Chaldeans, to the Babylonians? One of the great examples in the Bible, of course, you know, Daniel is full of it. There's, you know, four good examples that we can go through of, but he lived in Babylon. Now, if we read the Bible and look at things, you know, he wasn't part of this last segment. He was one of the first segments that got left under Jehoiakim. That got taken into Babylon. So he's already there when this final besiege is happening. But he was taken early on, and he was moved into Babylon. Think in his mindset, does he think this is a blessing or this is a curse? Is God blessing him by the things that happened to him, or is it a test? And sometimes we have to think of it. So in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, besieged it, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them into the land of Shinar, in the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. And so we have Zedekiah being appointed as king because of Jehoiakim, colon, but then he pulls these things and they bring them from Jerusalem, the house of God, to the house of Shinar, the god of Babylon. And they put them in the treasury. Verse 3, and the king ordered Asphaz, the king of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and the nobles, the youths in which there was no defects, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding, discernment, knowledge, and who had the ability for serving in the king's court. And then he ordered him to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine in which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, and at the end of which they would enter the king's personal service. Now among them were the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and to Daniel he assigned the name of Belshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, and to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. So those are names that we actually all recognize. We can think about some of the stories that are there. And this little thing down in the corner, just for reference, is an archaeological find that actually came from, we read in the previous verses, and how they brought the stuff into the house of the Lord. Well, this is a receipt for a deposit into their houses of their God that they took from other lands. So again, it shows this process. The Bible's correct. This is the process that happened. And you would go and you take the loot and you would take people and then you would deposit it into the house of the local God. And that's just an archaeological find of that. So here we have Daniel and his buddies taken into captivity, removed from the land of Israel, taken into Babylon, and then to be educated and taken away. So it's not going to be really a tough life. And they're given the choice food of the king. Well, it's the choice food of the king. It's not the food of God. And of course, we know that they didn't eat that. They decided that, no, Daniel said, no. But notice how it puts this. Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food and the wine he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. So Daniel had in his mind what? I reflect God. God is going to walk with me if I don't leave him behind. If I don't defile myself with that food that the king likes, and we're not told what the food is. But he already had made up in his mind that it would defile him. It would make him unclean. It would make him so that God wouldn't want to walk with him, dwell with him, tabernacle with him. His mind was made up. And you can read down through the rest of the story there, and he was blessed because of it. And he rose up in position versus succumbing. And it might be a worldly blessing to be actually chosen to be, you know, at the king's court. What a great position to have. But would I rather dwell and walk with my God and reflect him in his ways? That is the question. Now, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. He was troubled in his sleep, and they gave orders to all the magicians and conjurers and sorcerers and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams and then tell him what they meant. And again, here's another story, another time where Daniel's going to be put on the spot. Do I walk with God? Do I seek God? Do I seek his wisdom? Or do I do the thing that's convenient? So we know that the magicians of the land could not do it, and so the king got very upset, and they were to be destroyed. And so verse 11 says, moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there's no one who could declare to the king except the gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. So they knew that only a god could reveal these answers. And so they didn't even try. And of course, because of this, they became indignant. Furious, they gave orders to destroy all the wise men. And this is the scenario. And then Daniel gets tapped on the shoulder. Hey, come do this. We're already killing all the other ones that can't answer the thing. That's walking in Babylon, walking in this world. How many times do we maybe in this world have to have been tapped on the shoulder and said, I need you to do this, I need you to do that, but it's not of God? How do we respond? Do we go and seek godly counsel? Do we pray to God? Daniel here in verse 14 says, when Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, he had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. And he said to Arioch, the king's commander, for what reason is the decree of the king urgent? And Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in, requested the king that would give him some time in order that he might declare the interpretation of the king. Do we have that kind of confidence in what God is walking with? If we're walking and dwelling with God, do we have that kind of confidence that, hey, I can open up his book, I can do some study, and there's going to be an answer in there for me? If I'm walking with God, do I have that kind of confidence? And then Daniel went into his house. What did he do? He informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, about the matter so that they might request compassion from God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Daniel blessed the God of heaven. It's pretty amazing if you actually think about it. Because we're told to do the same thing. Go to one another. Seek counsel. Not from worldly counselors. Not from the king's wise men. But from our brothers and sisters that we know are studying God's word, that are trying to walk with God, and we'll receive answers. This is one of the ways we walk in Babylon. This is one of the ways that we can follow God, and we can walk, and we can do his thing, his bidding, and we can reflect him and his glory. And again, notice that the wise men knew that only God could reveal. The king knew that only God could reveal. The glory goes to God. But the simple steps of praying to God, seeking the wise counsel, studying his word, that's up to us. That's so we can walk with God. Again, the fiery furnace is another story. Again, this one involves the other three. Not just Daniel. It's not just a prophet of God. It's all of us. We're all involved. We'll all be given our tasks. And we know the story of the fire furnace, right? They declared a thing. They'd have to walk through there. Anytime these band would play and whatever, you'd have to go down and worship the image of the king. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're Babylon given names, said no. And their minds were made up. They knew the answer was no before they even started. Are we that sure of God's way, God's will? Have we studied and walked with God enough to say no? Verse 16 of Daniel 3 says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. And even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. Are we that sure? Are we walking with God and have faith in our God? He's going to do what's best for us. He's going to do the things that we need to have done. He's going to do those things. We can go on with other stories of in Babylon, because there's a bunch there. And we can keep reading that. But one of these lessons that keeps coming up and over again is you prepare ahead of time. We're prepared ahead of time. Have we thought and meditated? And that's part of the reasons that, you know, he says, come together in my appointed times so that you can prepare ahead of time. We can share our stories, our struggles. You know, what have you been struggling with? What comes up in the last year? What have you faced? And we can meditate on it and we can think about it. And one of the questions is, you know, how and what are your lines that you won't cross? Okay, I've been taken into captivity and I've been given a chance to eat this big banquet of what they call food, but I know it will defile me because it's not what God asked me to eat. Do I know where that line is? Is that line in the sand? And I go that far and I will not go any farther because I want to glorify my God. I want to walk with my God. You know, Daniel and his friends, they had to live that in Babylon. As we said, Babylon's still here, but Babylon's going to become a more of a force. We think about his friends and say, how would I respond? Because I may face those same things. They may be coming for me. And then another question that brings us all up is, you know, how silly or an irrational task will you do or not do for God? Now, the Bible is full of that. And when we think about this world, we think about coming out here. Okay, it's a silly task. Let's assemble, you know, 8 days in a strange place where everybody else is going about their business and worship God. Well, hey, that's a silly task. But when we look at the Bible, it's full of even more sillier tasks. Think about Noah. What if God came and says, okay, I want you to build an ark and go out in the Sahara Desert and do it? Sounds pretty silly. But we know the rest of that story. How about Moses? He said to go out in front of all those Egyptians that are trying to kill you and the people of Israel that's ready to slay you because you put them in front of a sea where they have no escape, and hold your staff up above a sea. Sounds pretty silly, but he asked somebody to do it. He asked Moses. How about Joshua? He tells him, carry that ark and go around the city. All those people in there are going to defend the city and they want it, but you're going to just blow a trumpet and walk around the city. How silly. Gideon is another one. You're going to enter a major battle. Get rid of all those soldiers. Get rid of all those weapons. We don't need that. God asked all these people to do these things. Then how about Ezekiel? You know, I think about this task and, you know, lie on your left side for 390 days for the punishment of the nations. Huh? And then you want me to do another 40 on the other side? Does this make any sense? But if we're walking with God, why do we have to ask? Is this what he asks of us to make sense? We do it, and then we understand. He asks us to dwell with him for 8 days. But then he asks us to tabernacle with him every day of our lives. Let's do it. I'll go back to this chart, which is kind of an interesting thing when we actually analyze some things on it. And again, this is not prophecy. This is not anything other than ponder. He said there's a lot of things that happen with 400 years, 400 plus or minus years. And we talked about, you know, from the start of the kingdom all the way to them being carried off entirely into captivity of 464 years, right? You know what? Then, you know, it was captivity in Babylon. And I ponder that, and then I ponder this nation that God created. And it was a nation under God, one God, the true God. It's no longer that way. It's no longer that way. And when I look, when this nation was first established, the first permanent settlement in the U.S. is St. Augustine. It was in 1565. You know, that was 459 years ago. And I see the Philistines, Palestinians, I see the Middle East, I see the other countries that are out there. Is God getting ready to put us back into Babylon captivity? It's just something to ponder. You know, and as we're walking around and we're dwelling with God and thinking about God and saying, well, the gods of this world aren't there anymore, I come back to some things like this. This is Dionysius. And I don't know if anybody was really paying attention, I'm sure. Most people here were paying attention somewhat. But Dionysius lives and reigns today. And if you recognize this picture here, it got a lot of things of Christ in the Last Supper. Christ in the Last Supper. But it was a celebration to Dionysius, a Greek god. It was a celebration of him. And the world glorified it. And yes, there was some objections. But the world glorified it this year at the Olympics and dedicated the Olympics to Dionysius. We're in Babylon. Do we bow to the gods of this world? Or do we bow to God? As we are dwelling with him and thinking about dwelling and walking with God, I got an interesting letter from Israel's Institute of Biblical Studies that I'm going to share a section of it, because it is powerful and it deals with Sukkot. And they break down dwelling with God. So as the autumn air settles in Israel, we celebrate Sukkot. The Feast of Tabernacles is a time when we remember God's protection during the Israelites' desert wanderings. As we've discussed, not only Israelites' desert wandering, our wanderings in Egypt, our sojourning, our alienation in this world. He said, in the biblical Hebrew, the word for temporary dwellings is sukkah, from the root of eskeke, meaning to cover or to shelter. This linguistic gem unveils the essence of sukkah, a celebration of the divine protection that goes far beyond physical shelter. As we're talking about walking and dwelling with God, it goes far beyond the physical shelter. It's where we are, what are we doing, how are we walking with God and having him dwell with us. But the Hebrew Bible uses the profound language to describe the concept of divine shelter, particularly in Leviticus 23:42, which we read. But Basukot, Tishru, Shavat, Yamin, which is also simply translated as you shall dwell in booths for 7 days. But the original Hebrew offers deeper insights. The word teshvu comes from the root yeshiva. This does just mean to dwell, but it implies settling, inhabiting, and even thriving. Is the same root used to describe Shabbat, the word, Hebrew word for Sabbath. Are we doing those things when we're here, but also as we go out in this world? Are we inhabiting, settling, and thriving in God's word? With God walking with us, dwelling with us, reflecting. These are powerful things that are hidden in the Hebrew. And you've got to forgive my Hebrew because I don't have any good Hebrew. I'm terrible at English. But the meanings, we can walk away with those. Are we settling, inhabiting, and thriving this feast? The use of the preposition ba, Sukkot, in the meaning of in rather than al or on suggests the complete immersion in the Sukkah experience, not just the physical experience. Are we completely immersed? That's a job that each one of us actually has. Do we fully immerse ourselves in Sukkot? Because that's the meaning of that command to dwell for 7 days. And speaking of which, Shevat, meaning seven, shares with the root of Sheva, which can mean fullness or completeness, just like a week is full and complete after 7 days. Ever wonder why he says 7 days? Because it makes it full and complete. Are we here? Are we with God, dwelling with him and each other for 7 days? If we're not, we're missing it. We're not fully immersing ourselves. If we're not getting the completeness out of it, are we fully immersing? And so then they conclude with, you see, Sukkot is not merely a historic commemoration, it's a call for total spiritual engagement with an all-encompassing nature of God's protection, of God walking with us. All-encompassing, every aspect of our lives. And when we go into these temporary dwellings in a way, we're relying on God, more so than when we're at our homes and in our typical routines. So we have total spiritual engagement, all-encompassing nature of God. Does God encompass our entire nature, especially during this time? And they end with that, are you ready to experience the fullness of God's shelter? Are you prepared to immerse yourself in his protection? That's a question for each of us. You know, we come to the feast, are we really going to be involved? Are we immersing ourselves totally and fully? Do we prepare for that? Do we get up in the morning and say, I'm prepared to be fully immersed today with the spiritual blessings and food that God has given me today? And it may be as well some of the physical blessings. We're in a beautiful location. There's so many beautiful things of God's creations to look at and wonder. Are we taking advantage of that and giving the glory back to God? And as we walk and observe those things, do somebody else, as they're observing us, say, their walk's a reflection of God, because God is walking with them. These are things to think about, because Babylon is out there. Babylon is that world that we're in today. Babylon is where we're told the tabernacle. We have our captivity of different things today. We have a vision of what is going to come. But what's out there today? How do we reflect God? How do we tabernacle? Not only here, but in our lives. And that is a message that God has for each and every one of us. And only each and every one of us can answer how we're going to walk each day. Are we going to fully immerse ourselves every single day with God and walk with God? Because he wants to tabernacle. Preordained, he told you to be here. He had knowledge that he foreknew and he called out you out. What are you going to do with that? Because he wants to tabernacle with us. And he wants us to tabernacle together and multiply his spirit to be seen, to give him the glory.